Eight interlinked stories of ordinary people whose lives are touched by the gods make up a new collection by Iranian-American Kiwi writer Mahir Amuzigar. The Hubris in an Empty Hand is his fourth book. Some of Mahir's characters understand they are in the presence of or have received a gift from a god, while others are oblivious. Friendships and relationships are tested. And what if someone who receives a gift to do good becomes addicted to it and are unwilling to do what must be done to keep it alive and pass it on to another person? Mahir reads from the story called Joseph.
It felt as if time had stopped. At least that's how I remember the accident, with every detail so vividly pronounced. I saw the massive truck inches away from the driver's side with its shiny chrome bulldog sitting keenly on top of the hood, looking straight through the window. I saw the smoke from the tires rising in the air in a circular fashion, creating dirty dust devils, and the cabin bending forward under the weight of its hull as it tried to slow down faster than the designer had intended. I saw fear in the driver's eyes. Then time started again, and I saw death. And there was a strange calm in the air. I saw the red lights and the darkened hills before I heard the siren. The fire truck pulled next to our car, followed by ambulance. I wondered who had called them and how much time had passed since the accident. A young man came out of the ambulance and ambled toward me, and I could see his face under the moonlight. He was so young and looked fearless. He looked at the flashlight from his bag and shined the light on our car and then on my face. I felt as if God was looking at me.
First of all, and I seem to be asking this question quite a lot of my Kiwi writers over the last year or two, how do you define your book? Because I wasn't sure, you know, on the bookshelf, where does it go? Because it's slippery as a genre.
It is, and that's good. I like it to be slippery. I'm hoping to be considered literary fiction, but it's a love story. It's about life and humanity. Definitely about gods, but not in a religious sense, right? All my novels are about human relationships. There's such a section. That would be my section.
And also, you have these eight interconnected, fully interconnected stories. I mean, it reads like a novel, but there's also this element of how it's structured with these different stories.
Right. So, you know, every time I write a book, I try to sort of challenge myself. So I write very organically, but I always do one challenge for every book. And this book, my challenge was, could I write eight short stories that read like short stories? If somebody wants to read them randomly and independently, but also have enough of an arc that you can read it like a novel. So that's why, you know, it's not just short stories, but also it's a novel that happened to be short stories.
Well, we get to know the characters very well because we have this through link. And I thought of them, we might start with Charles Stock, a lawyer, who has a gift, and this is a gift, the propagator of joy, I've seen it described as. He's able to bestow, if you like, empathy and solace and contentment on his fellow human beings. How does Charles, in every other way, an everyday guy, come to have this remarkable gift?
A few years ago, when I just moved to New Orleans, it was like 4 or 5 years ago, and I was going through some medical issues, you know, dealing with some medical things. And I was going through radiation and everything else. And it was also the Trump era. So while I was going through this sort of mind-bending thing of a personal nature of my own, as Trump was becoming Trumpy and the country was becoming more Trumpy, and I was wondering what is going on with us as human beings, sort of a lack of empathy there was, the type of misery that's been inflicted on people, what is happening with, you know, information and knowledge, and is it decaying? So is it decaying like a fruit? So therefore, I thought of the three gods, the knowledge, empathy, and misery, and how would they react to us as human beings, how we interact with each other. They try to impart more of their gifts to us to make us better. Is that going to help or is it going to hurt? And as I was thinking about life and death, I wondered, how would death play a role here? Would he, she, they be a sympathetic person? Would it be charismatic? Would it be, you know, like a mean person? So that was the genesis of this whole idea of imparting the gift of empathy. So Stark by himself is sort of a random person in some sense. He's a nice guy. And the idea that the gift of empathy, did it make him better or did it make him worse? Did he sort of gave up something for his love or did he sort of gain something? So that's the essence of these characters in the book.
It's quite a quandary for him because you say at times, you know, he feels like he's addicted to the gift. He knows that he is to pass it on. He knows that this gift to survive and thrive cannot stay with one person forever. At some stage, he has to make a decision to pass it on as it was passed to him. But this feeling like a parent who wants to keep his child with him forever, but knows at some stage right. The child will have to leave. He's really conflicted.
In some ways, he wants to protect Dahlia because, you know, the gift, you know, wants her as well. Otherwise, he's being selfish because, you know, having so much empathy with him and the way he can touch people and help people is also something you want to keep. And, you know, the analogy is apt. You know, we love our children. We want them to stay with us. They give us solace. They're wonderful to have around. But they also grow up and you have to let them go. And it's hard to let them go. So it's both the act of love and act of selfishness at the same time. So I think Charles Stark goes through the same sort of type of dilemma.
He goes on a date to Dahlia just to kind of get to know her better before he passes it on. And then suddenly it's another date and another date and another date. And we all understand that procrastination of something. I mean, he genuinely cares for her. But as you say, also he's reluctant to pass on this gift, which is both a gift and a responsibility and a burden.
Right. It can be a gift and it can be a curse in some ways. And that's it. I mean, he didn't intend to fall in love, but he did. And when he fell in love, he wants to protect her. So it's sort of pull and push that he's feeling. He's addicted to the gift, but he also loves her. And, you know, and there's a dilemma. You know, if he gives it to her, then he won't have her, but he also has to give away the gift. And that's what we do every day, don't we? Make decisions about this. Not so dramatic, but to me, it was about the sort of the crossroads we come to in our lives and how we behave and how we change, how we react, you know, and the process we have, the inner process we have.
I felt it was also an examination, exploration of friendship. Because in some of the stories, the characters' friendships are tested. You've got this beautiful friendship between Dahlia and Zoli, who has a dreadful car accident and really needs Dahlia to see her through, you know, for them to be there for each other. But there can be frustrations within that really intense kind of relationship. You know, some resentments can come through as well. So it's very tangled.
Right. No, it is. In the same way that eight stories are intertwined, the lives of these people, these friends, are intertwined. And again, is that the idea is that how much we impact each other in through our friendships and family, and what happens when you sort of have a trauma in your life and how much you depend on each other. And also that adds more stress in your relationship. So Zoli feels that stress. And then he's also confused because one of the gods is sort of hanging out with her, right? And she can figure out, is it real? Is it imaginary? Am I gone crazy? Also, again, she's trying to protect her friend as well. So it's all about constantly, like us, you know, human beings, we try to protect each other. And how far do you go? And are you doing the right thing or the wrong thing? And Zoli has this dilemma as well. Yeah, you rightly put it.
You have, particularly perhaps in the last story, A Long Ornate Dinner Table, that kind of all-knowing narrator style in the way that you address us. You must pay close attention as this is an important story, and you drop some hints and you say, look, well, later, I'll address that later. I don't see this style of writing very often. Why was it important for you to wrap this in this way?
Did you figure out who the narrator is?
I can't tell you that because then it'll ruin it for the readers. But it is a puzzle.
Right, it is a puzzle. And that's the thing. It is all-knowing because in some ways, you know, you want to be subtle, but at the same time, you sometimes you get sort of criticized for having this sort of own omniscient type writing. But I think sometimes it's necessary. And this dinner, and the way I was thinking about it, you know, how we, all of us, you know, we have friends over for dinner and it starts very slow and then it picks up, then it is sort of top of an intensity, then slows down again. And we say things and we drink and reveal information and secrets. And I thought of this dinner that's narrated by this almighty powerful thing, it just be a wonderful thing to do, because this being can be around and narrate everybody's thoughts. And I love the idea of how we as human beings say something and think differently. You know, it's sort of a constant, you know, that we might say something, but we're thinking differently in our mind. I love to sort of explore that, the duality we have all the time. And that story is sort of, is all exposed. We can hear what they say out loud, but also we can somewhat read their minds too. And that's just, I thought it was great.
Now, the book is set in the United States. You're living in the United States, published in the United States. But I did see New Zealand references, particularly when it comes to wine. Was it important to you to have, you know, because this is home also, to have a New Zealand influence on the book?
Oh, definitely. You know, my home is San Francisco and it's in Palmerston North. So, you know, I love San Francisco. I love Palmerston North. I love New Zealand. And so, yeah, you know, it's a modern world in some sense. You know, I can live in two different countries all the time and enjoy both worlds. And now in the past 5-6 years, I've been living in New Orleans. And I write mostly set in San Francisco because this is a city I've grew up in. So I feel more comfortable. I sort of tend not to dare to write too much about other places, New Zealand or New Orleans. Somebody asked me a few years ago, is my next book is going to be set in New Orleans? And I put some of it in this book, but I don't think I'm ready. I don't think I feel like I'm enough of a New Orleanian to even write about this. New Zealand has had an amazing, huge impact on me. So of course, that's part of my thinking. Part, you know, of course, wonderful wines and food, but beyond that, just the people and the way we interact with each other. I mean, it's subtle, but part of this book is about how Kiwis interact with each other as well. You know, the kindness and the closeness. That's not necessarily in the States, right? So I don't say it's a Kiwi way, but I think if somebody understands how Kiwis live, will pick it up when they read the book. That there is some essence of Kiwiness in the book as well.
The Hubris of an Empty Hand is written by Mahir Amuzigar and published by University of New Orleans Press.